Hi everyone, this is your host Harmit, and you're listening to Tobin Talks.
Okay, my full name is Danielle Marie Behood. My pronouns are she, her. My position is instructor two and director of the planetarium. And then I don't know if or where it's relevant. I have a PhD, so I'm a doc.
Thank you. Okay, so could you tell me what the planetarium is all about?
Okay, so the planetarium is an immersive teaching and outreach space. And so it's used for astronomy classes so far and for public outreach. So outreach is university efforts to share knowledge with members of the community that are not necessarily in the classes or just the people of the city that have some interest.
Okay. And from the planetarium, what exactly is visible?
Okay, so this is a digital planetarium. And so the sky is the limit, almost literally. So we have three different softwares that we can run. So we have a astronomy software, and so we can see all of the stars that are visible to the naked eye and more. We can see all of the galaxies. We could fly to any of the planets in our solar system, and we can fly to any of the exoplanets, so planets that are orbiting around other stars. And so the planetarium software pulls from professional astronomy databases, like NASA databases. So like the number and the location and the size of all of the planets that are being shown are simulations, but the simulations are accurate to what we know about those worlds.
Okay, so the main equipment used are, it's mainly the software that are used.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of computers with a lot of graphics processing power, and then we have a projector here, and then there's a fisheye lens.
Okay.
And the fisheye lens projects it up to cover the whole space. And then we have this dome, which is essentially a big reflection screen. And so the software contains astronomy. We also have like a geophysics, atmospheric climate science software. And then we also have an anatomy software. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and I wanted to ask, what is the size of the factor?
So the size, it's an 8-meter diameter dome. So when people talk about planetariums, they often measure the diameter of the dome. And it seats 48.
48 people.
Yes, or great. You know.
Perfect. And could you tell me more about the open houses that you have?
Yeah, so the open houses are an old tradition at the U of M that have been going on since before I got here. So they were started by Ian Cameron. And so once a month, we invite people into a space and into summit. But yes, we invite people in to listen to a talk. And so the past couple open houses have talked about indigenous constellations, what's visible in our night sky from Winnipeg. And then in May, we have like a geophysics one. And so we just invite anybody who's interested to come and learn a little bit about astronomy or science.
Okay, so it's open to everybody.
It's open to everybody. They don't have to be affiliated with the university at all.
Okay, and when is the next when is the next open house going to be?
So they are always on the last Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. And so the next one is March 29th. There are, they're advertised on the website and on the Instagram page.
Oh, there we go. The astronomy is working.
Okay. Yeah, so they're available on, or they're advertised on the website, the Faculty of Science events page, and the Lockhart Planetarium Instagram. And there's an Eventbrite ticket, just because we've sold out for the last few. And so we're also already sold out for March and April. So people reserve spots, just because I don't want to have to turn people away at the door.
And what is the topic for the next
Probably a tour of the solar system. I'm giving the talk. I haven't decided yet. But yeah, so it's probably a tour of the planets in the solar system.
Thank you, no problem. And how is the, it's usually sold out. So how are people's reactions when they get here?
That's a good one.
What is happening?
Okay. Well, this is... I think it just completely reset itself.
You overlight? Usually...
When you turn down the lights, there's a lot of like... And like when you fly places, people are like, whoa. No, and that's really fun as a presenter to have people kind of like amazed at what they can see. And I think that's one of my favorite parts of astronomy is that so much of it is so beautiful that it evokes awe. And when you look up outside, you're subject to like cloud cover or needing a big telescope, and in the planetarium you don't need any of that, and you can still get that same reaction, which is kind of fun.
Thank you. Is it pretty funny a bit about the history of the planetarium? I know it's pretty old, but you guys had some renovations done.
Yeah,
the thought of the pandemic.
Yeah, so the planetarium has been on campus since the 70s. So it's been, I think, the university's best kept secret. So we had what was called an optomechanical projector. And if you have time after this, the old projector is actually encased in the tunnels, like right next to Duff Roblin. So it's in a big glass case.
Yeah, I know what I...
Yeah, so it's like right by all the windows.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. So that used to be right here, and there was like a podium, and it would start like up to near. So it was really, really big. So that was running for a really long time. That projector was a Spitz A3P optomechanical projector, which is essentially like a big sphere with a bulb inside with holes and lenses poked into it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Spitz Cydone 2400. Yes, on the
biggest distance.
Yeah. So it's the same company, but it's a digital projector, which means that we're a little more flexible in terms of what we can show.
Okay.
The renovation started in May of 2017, and it took a few years, and we redid everything, like the walls, the carpet, the chairs, and it finished late February 2020, just in time for the pandemic. And then everybody was off campus, and so we didn't have any events. And so last term was the first term where we started having people in. We started our first open house in January, and I'm hoping to just slowly increase how many shows we have and how many people we can have in here.
You know, that's really story offering for. Okay, what would you say is the overall goal of the planetarium?
The overall goal of the planetarium is to, I think, inspire curiosity in people about astronomy, about the stars, and I hope to inspire people to look up out when they're outside a little more.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And why is this important to you?
Why is it important to me? It's important for a few different reasons. One is that I think astronomy is wonderful. I think thinking about our place in the universe, both kind of like physically and philosophically, is important. And I think astronomy is a really good way to unlock that.
Because
when you think about astronomy, you think about how small you are and how important and unique Earth is.
Mm-hmm.
I also feel like sharing knowledge and sharing what we know about astronomy is a privilege. And so I think it's important to be able to invite people that wouldn't necessarily have access to these spaces.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, those are all my questions. Was there anything at all you'd like to add, favor, anybody?
Oh, man. Cool, there was to add. We do, so the planetarium does like shows by request. So it's possible to have private bookings. So we've had groups like the Boy Scouts book shows. So those are for a little bit of a cost, but that'll be good. And I'm hoping to like use those funds to hire studios so we can have more shows.
Mm-hmm.
What else is important to say? It's a Faculty of Science facility. And I think, yeah, I think it's also a fun space, really. Science communication. So an opportunity for students and volunteers to learn to speak to general public.
Okay, I'll try.
Yeah. And how do you volunteer to actually, how do you, we just reach out to each foot?
Yeah, if you want to volunteer, you just reach out to me, and then I put you on a list, and then every time there's an opportunity, I've done it.
Could you please say your name?
My name is Caitlin Gonsalves. My pronouns are she, her.
And what is your role at UM Anime?
So I am a event planner for under the events team.
Mm-hmm. And you're a student at the U of M, right?
Correct, yes.
In the Department of English?
That's right. Department of English, and I'm currently doing my coursework for master's degree.
Great. So, did you start the manga club for UM Anime?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, for the event planning, we're actually split into two groups. So, one is for bigger events, meaning that there are going to be expectations of bigger crowds. And then second group, which I am part of, is smaller events. And those events are technically, sometimes even smaller crowds or events that can easily be taken care of within a week rather than planning a bigger event.
Yeah.
And it correlates with me being an English major. I think with the current team we have, President wants to kind of go beyond what the Anime Club usually does. And a big part of it is because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So a lot from my understanding of what happened with the club, everything became online. And of course, U of M, this is the first year we came back on campus. So the main goal was to come up with as much events as we can so that students can come and interact. Another part is our club room is very small because when anime kind of started in the early 2000s, you could kind of imagine anime was very niche. So you can imagine there was only probably a handful of people who were in it. But as of now, in 2010, we have over 200? Over 270 current members. So anime has become very mainstream.
Yeah.
So obviously, coming up with events. So there's usually 3 or 4 events per month so that all these members can come and interact and do everything. Sorry, this is like a long answer, but...
No, that's great. So you had said that you told me that at the last manga club meeting, there were over 30 people?
Yeah, there were about 30 people.
Why manga for the events that you're holding?
We were talking about giving ideas, and we had the anime screening, and it hit me when someone mentioned that... You know, when there was a club room, people were able to exchange or share manga.
Mm.
And I also got the same similarity in one of our coffee hours, talking to people saying, like, oh, you know, this is my favorite manga. This is what I read. And I came across the idea of, like, well, we could have some sort of, in a way, kind of like a book club where if I were to, you know, set up a time where, hey, why don't you read these titles and we'll come and actually talk about it. So yeah, I wanted a kind of a space where not so much it's going beyond of talking to friends of like, oh, this is what I read or this is what I read. I kind of wanted to be like, okay, well, how about we read this genre, or how about we, you know, get people to actually be introduced to like different manga, so that they can kind of get into it.
Right. And so I had another question after that, but you said that there was a club room. Did you guys lose it?
It's not that we've lost it. It's just really small.
Right, right, right. Got it.
So
you're not using it anymore?
We're only using it for staff and storage, because it's not, I'm trying to think of a comparison, but it's basically one round table and a couple of those chairs can fit in there. So even like, because we have events currently, even if we try to make an event in the club room, it's not big enough.
Right, right, right.
So how it's preoccupied right now is staff will have meetings there. And I think currently is being used for, because there's going to be this right now being used for people who are running to be the next president for next year. So they're kind of using that for campaigning purposes. So yeah, it's not so much it's not existent. It's just impossible to hold stuff there with the amount of, we have like over 270 club members. That's, you know, we can't do that, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So, do you feel like your skills as an English major are useful to facilitating discussions about manga?
Yeah, what I am, because I, especially in, you know, in grad school, I'm at a point where I'm, you know, it's not as simply as like where you learn from high school, like, oh, can you name what is the introduction? What is the climax? I know it's more than that. Where, you know, I could, in a way, come up with questions after reading the manga. It's like, okay, what are some, you know, I have some settled generic questions that can go with any manga. But then the last questions I always think about, okay, well, what about this certain character or this certain case? For instance, in The Deranged Detective, I asked, one of the questions were, well, which case was your favorite and why? And with Marshall, I asked the question, like, would you prefer magic or muscles and why? So that definitely, as like being an English major, that definitely helps. And you kind of, and even in conversation wise with other, because I prefer, again, I'm not really necessarily giving a seminar or presentation on these, but when I sit down with other students, I could kind of get out of them of like, okay, they're saying, oh, this is my favorite character. And it's like, okay, well, why is that your favorite character? Or like, oh, what do you think of like the art style? Let's take a look. Like the lines. Like it's nice to, because as an English major, you kind of, you're focused on like the critical thinking of like different themes and the depthness of characters or the genre. And I think, and especially in the last meeting, I was surprised how, like I understand everyone's students, and not knowing what their background is currently, but it's nice to see students really getting into talking about the manga and, like, bringing up different stuff that I never thought about, which is pleasant to see rather than, like, simply, like, answering yes or no. So I try to ask like very broad questions.
Yeah. So, do you think that there are benefits to meeting in person to talk about manga? Because it's something that you couldn't really do during lockdown.
Yeah. I think, what I like about being in person is, and I feel like I relate this to lectures. When you have a class lecture, you're there to hear the meeting, and then once the meeting's ended, like, you turn off your computer. Whereas what I like about meeting up is, yeah, you can talk in person, which you can do online, but it's the after. Because then after, people can, you know, talk amongst themselves, actually, you know, build friendships and leave the manga club and be like, hey, what are you doing after this? Because with online, it's kind of you're there for one purpose and then you just look away. Whereas I think, and that's the reason why we try to make match events possible, because we want to build these relationships. So it's kind of like that in-betweenness of the meeting.
So my last question for you is, what are your hopes and or goals for the manga club specifically?
Well, I started the manga club and I'm still learning a few things. Like, of course, I have to pay attention more to the academic schedule and also make sure to pick a time where everyone's available. So my marketing could be a bit better. But also what I hope to do is I really hope that I put a good impression in this club that someone can eventually take over and continue. So far, I've gotten, you know, good response with the last meeting. It's a good turnout. And, you know, I think with, like, the staff members, too, they think it's really such a really good idea to have. And it's also nice because students can kind of stay away. You know, they're reading, like, or, like, not want to say boring, but they're reading textbooks and things they have to read. So it's nice to have a reason to, you know, read something fun, manga.
Yeah. Is there anything you wanted to add that we haven't talked about?
I guess a goal for this club, I don't know if I mentioned it already, but what I've noticed is when it comes to anime, I guess both anime and manga, there's definitely a favoritism in genre, shonen definitely being one of them. And there's definitely a loss of, like, for example, shoujo is unfortunately getting a decrease. There's not a lot of shoujo. And there's a lot of, if you know the genre, isekai is, that's like getting recycled because that is such a profitable brand, even if it's just the same plot and character tropes and everything. So my plan is for, you know, even though it's just the U of M crowd, my plan is to show, to kind of show and broaden the spectrums of genre and manga so that we're not stuck into this, like, popularity contest.
So I'm Margaret Shaw McKinnon, and that is spelled M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, and then Shaw, capital S, then H-A-W, hyphen, capital M-A-C, capital K-I-N-N-O-N. And I am she, her. And I am a writer and painter and artist.
I guess, Margaret, to start off with, I wanted to ask you how exactly the exhibit became to be. How was it born?
Well, it was born out of understanding that my great-grandparents, Pazia and Senko Ketchkowski, were really kind of lost in the family tree. And there was ethnic discrimination throughout the first half of the 20th century, in particular in Manitoba and in Canada broadly. And many people changed their name, dropped their Eastern European heritage in order to accept colonization. And so between Between that and then life trajectories, these great grandparents had really kind of, you know, been lost to the family tree. And so I began researching into this about 12 years ago, and
wow,
I've gone through many phases with it and sort of learning a bit at a time. And then with the war in Ukraine, I just felt like I have got to delve into this in a deep way as sort of solidarity with the people of Ukraine, many of whom are becoming refugees and immigrants to many countries in the world, whether they want to or not. And it was time to delve into this. So it's been an amazing year of immersing into the lives of first wave Ukrainian immigrants and into retrieving my family heritage that was lost through ethnic discrimination and life trajectories. So first I was involved in a lot of reading, very broad reading across many categories. You know, I really didn't know the history of Ukraine. And so I read in that direction and learned that war was commonplace and had been part of Ukraine's history since the 9th century, and that Ukraine itself means borderland, and it was the border of many different countries that would choose to invade it over and over. And that war and oppression had long been part of the story, and that many tragedies had taken place in that territory, as well as a wonderful culture, a wonderful heritage,
yeah.
And that I was reading into that as well, you know, getting out books on Pysonki and, you know, looking at the beautifully colored eggs and reading about the rebirth and the symbolism within those beautifully painted folkloric art pieces, and I looked into painters, Ukrainian painters, and looked into the history of war itself, you know, so that I was looking at Chris Hedges' The Evils of War, and then also it was so exciting to me to read accounts of first wave Ukrainian immigrants that were captured in books like Land of Pain, Land of Promise, where the actual stories were recorded. And in the midst of all this reading, I was reading through that particular book and was absolutely amazed to come across a piece by a man who was a friend of my great-grandfather's.
Oh, wow.
And he wrote about my great-grandfather, a passage about him. And from that, I learned that they had built a church together because there wasn't a church. There wasn't a church for Ukrainians at that time, and they built this church, and then
For 9 years, my great-grandfather preached in that church. And it these kinds of synchronicities were happening all the time, where all of a sudden I would need to know about something, and there it would appear. And so then after that, then I started in on the painting, and that was a very interesting process because I wanted to capture the history and yet make the paintings accessible and folkloric and narrative. Yeah. And so I wove in little symbols that have meaning and painted with colors that also have meaning. You know, for instance, there are soldiers in the first border, and they're wearing blue uniforms and carrying bayonets, and that was the color of that the soldiers wore in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was what Galicia was part of at that time in the wave of immigration. And so things like that, little details. Taras Shevchenko's portrait is the famous poet and painter of Ukraine, the beloved, inspiring poet and painter, is in a little miniature in a corner of a painting. And there are all these things to find and discover within these paintings.
Just a reminder that if you ever have any suggestions or feedback for people who you'd like to see on the podcast, if you'd like to be on the podcast, if you want to send in any of your poetry, short stories, any of those types of things, please email me at audio@themanitoban.com. You can find Tobin Talks Thursdays at 11:30 on 101.5 FM radio, which is UMFM radio, and you can listen to us anytime on all of your podcast streaming services, such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts. That's it for today, and we'll see you on the next episode of Tobin Talks.